Welcome to my ministry mission, where faith's transformative power comes to life. Sit back and relax as we dive into God's Word together, finding hope, guidance, and inspiration for our lives. Be sure to check out today's show notes for extra resources, updates, and ways to connect with our growing community. Or head on over to myministrymission.com to get more information, contact me, become a guest, and so much more. God has placed a calling of ministry in my heart, and I'm answering that call, sharing my journey of faith, tackling tough questions, and encouraging you to live boldly for Christ. So I hope you're ready to ignite your spiritual flames. My name is Jason, and this is my mission. Welcome and thank you for listening. My name is Jason and I'm your host. By the time we all reach adulthood, there's some trauma, some challenge that reaches out from our past to drag us down on a daily basis. Maybe you come from a broken home. Maybe you suffered childhood abuse. Maybe you were abandoned or neglected. Whatever it is, however strong those claws of the past can be, I assure you that the glory of God's future is so much better. And my guest for this episode is a shining example of what can be if you trust Christ to take control of your life. John Boyle is a man who grew up oppressed by a past riddled with abuse, and on top of that, he was perceived as a second-class citizen simply because of where he grew up. He took a few wrong turns in life, but God stepped in and made his path straight. And we're going to get to know our honored guest and talk about his book, The Appalachian Kid, How Hope Changed Everything. You will find more information at appalachiankid.com or go to my show notes, and you'll find links to the website and his social media, including his YouTube channel. And be sure to put The Appalachian Kid on your reading list. It's a book you just can't put down. If you struggle with demons from your past, you won't want to miss this conversation. So, welcome, John. I am so thrilled to have you here today.
Thank you for having me, Jason. I'm really looking forward to the show. And I have to say, that's probably the best intro I've ever received. I'm touched.
Oh, thank you. Now, you gave me three Bible verses. I like to go over the favorite Bible verse. Started out with James 29:11. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you a hope and a future. And then Romans 8:28, and we know that on all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called to according to his purpose. And then finally, Romans 10:9, if you declare with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. Now, all three of these seem to interact with each other. You have God's plans giving you hope. You have God's purpose. You have God's salvation through Christ. And it's all kind of related to this overarching hope and obedience and living life according to God's will. I mean, would you agree? What do these verses say to you?
I would agree. You know, they mean more to me than just what they say. Right. So with Jeremiah 29:11, the first time I ever sat down and read through the Bible from start to finish, I was probably 37. And that one just popped out at me. Jeremiah is at the end of the Old Testament. And I just remember reading that and thinking, you know, it just reinforces the fact that God knows what you're going to go through before you're born. He knows the adversity you face. He understands your challenges. He understands the good and the bad, and he understands that you have a choice too here on earth of whether you want to follow him and listen to his commandments or not, right? And so that to me, it makes me believe that God has a plan for my life, and I've never read a story in the Bible that's half finished. And that to me gave me hope, right? And
yeah, that's
it
true.
Helped me slog through the more difficult periods of my life. Romans 8:28 was actually a verse that I really had a lot of difficulty with. Romans 8:28, when it says that all things are used for good and for those who love the Lord and who are called according to their purpose, you know, we're going to get into this, but I grew up in a violent home, right? And when you have that type of childhood and you deal with the ramifications of those actions as an adult, in that I have a complex version of post-traumatic stress disorder, it's hard to see that that can be used for good. And for probably 7 or 8 years after I turned to Christ, I really had a lot of difficulty in understanding that my story, my childhood, my struggles, my addiction, it can all be used for good. And that's the premise of my book, right? And now I believe it. I believe every single thing I went through was used for a higher purpose. And moreover, I believe because of that verse that I am no victim. No victim.
Very good.
Yep. And lastly, Romans 10:9 is just simply something I share with a believer who is making a turn towards faith in their life and looking to turn their hopes toward Jesus. And Romans 10:9 just simply says that salvation is a gift, and it's simple. All you have to do is declare that Jesus is the King of your life and believe that God raised him from the dead, and you will be saved. It is that easy. Now, there's a lot more to it, but that's a wonderful first step to know that. And so that's why those are my favorite verses.
I like that. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. Now, you mentioned it, I briefly mentioned in the introduction, the abuse. When you and I first spoke, you made it kind of clear you didn't want to go into too many details on that subject. You didn't want to focus on that. So I'm going to purposely leave that there. And if anyone wants to read more about your experiences, they can read your book. Let's just acknowledge that it was part of your journey. And if the conversation leads that way, you feel free to share what you want. But on top of that, you were told by your teachers that you'd never make it to college. You had it rough early on, but you managed to break free of those bonds,
I did.
I assume with Christ's help. I mean, do you want to say any more about that? Or
Sure. So growing up, I grew up in a Christian home. I grew up Catholic. My family, my father took us to church every Sunday. And I fully believe that my parents both had good intentions in regards to religion, in regards to raising us in a Christian home. But just to unpack a little bit of it, Jason, there was a bifurcation between our home life and how we spent Sunday morning. And it was difficult for me to disassociate from that home life. And so when I would go to school, I would just kind of sit and stare. I wouldn't pay attention to what the teacher was teaching. I wouldn't do my homework. I periodically, you know, just went in and out of having good grades and having bad grades. And many of my teachers perceived it as laziness and that I was a daydreamer. And they just didn't understand. It was, you know, you didn't talk about your home life, especially in the 1980s. And we just didn't live in a society at that time that had any onus on mental health. And so I didn't know where to turn. I asked others for help and just didn't really get anybody that bid on the request. So by the time I got to sixth grade, my sixth grade teacher told my parents in front of me at a parent teacher conference that there's no way I would ever go to college.
That's terrible.
On the cards. And obviously she was wrong. I went to West Virginia University and I went to Harvard Business School and I did just fine, but there was a lot of work in between. And so anyway, I strayed from Christianity as I went to a private school for high school, and I was given kind of a lifeline to get out of my house, and I took it. And really, I had a period of, I would say 20 years where I really didn't have a faith life at all. You know, if I prayed, it was a Hail Mary prayer, and I needed something. I certainly wasn't asking God what he wanted from me, but he was there when I asked, and that says a lot for him.
That's amazing. And you talk about a lot of that in your book. We'll segue to there eventually, but I just have to say that reading the first few chapters of it, it's heart-wrenching, but it's a good story. But we'll get into that. But you're from West Virginia, and I mentioned there's common misconceptions about that. You cover this in your book. You debunk a lot of those misconceptions about the class of people who live there. Yeah. But this has been a real struggle for you. I mean, it may even still be a struggle for you, right?
Well, it's a struggle to hear. It's a struggle of understanding in our society. I'll be honest with you, when I started writing the book, I didn't know what to put in the first chapter. So I started writing chapter two, and I got most of the way through the book, and it just came to me. I have to lead with a rant, a mini rant of what it's like to be from West Virginia and how we're perceived by the rest of the country. And it's not that I have a crow to pick or anything, but I think it was important for the reader to understand my environment and where I'm coming from, not only from my home, but where I'm from. And, you know, as a West Virginian, it's common when you go beyond the borders of the state to hear banter about backwardness that is misunderstood by others. And so I don't tell some of the more troubling stories that I've had. I chose to use humor all I could. And because some of my story is heart-wrenching, I try to marry that with as much, you know, things that people can laugh at as I could. And so I share a few stories. One was going to Pitt Stadium. That's the University of Pittsburgh. They used to have an old stadium and by the university, and there was a public announcer at the West Virginia Pittsburgh game. They're playing right now, by the way, for the 107th time. They're big rivals. And you know, the public announcer gets on the loudspeaker and he says, "There's a tractor parked outside the like the East Concourse with West Virginia plates, EIEIO, right?" And, you know, obviously old McDonald wasn't at the game. It was just meant in good fun. There were other stories like there was a CBS special back in the 1980s. National exposure was far less common. There was a story of the Charles Kuralt show. He had a famous Sunday morning show for decades. And he came to my hometown in 1988 or 1989. I can't remember which one. And we were just kind of portrayed as peasants, you know, desperate peasants clawing for pride. And I even share one where I was in Beverly Hills, California for a conference. And I was in a line with the actor Don Johnson. And I had a t-shirt on and it just plainly said free coal. Well, apparently having the word coal on a t-shirt is highly offensive to a Californian. And I just would invite Don to toughen up and try being us, right? And that's just, you know, that's just kind of what it is. But I'll say this about the citizens of West Virginia, and I can't say enough kind words about them. They are people that would truly give you the shirt off their back. If you have a flat tire there, there are multiple people that pull over. I live in South Carolina outside Charleston, and I've never seen anybody pull over for a flat tire for anyone. It's just a free-for-all to get where you want to get in your own personal life. So, sorry, I don't mean to digress on the nuances of being a West Virginian, but, you know, it's a very interesting place, and it's got a rich history. And yeah. If you've never been there, it's beautiful, and I would recommend that you visit.
Yeah, and I'll say I learned some things about the state. I mean, you're very meticulous in the details. You wrote that West Virginia was the only state to reside completely within the borders of the Appalachian region. It's the only state to be, as you put it, carved out of another state in 1863 by popular vote to become the 35th state. And this happened because the interests of the people, the good people of West Virginia, didn't align to Virginia's interests with the Confederate. That's so right. They bailed. So, I mean, that's just some of the fun facts. There's a lot more in there. And as you go through the book, you do provide a lot of detail about a lot of different subjects. How fun was it learning all about the state and telling the story of West Virginia?
I had a lot of fun talking about my home state and sharing it with others. And I really believe that most people in the country have no idea what the history is of the state. And it's a small place, 1.8 million inhabitants. It's 161 years old. And, you know, oddly, my findings, my experience throughout the United States is the vast majority of people have no idea. It's a different state than Virginia. And most times when I tell people, Jason, that I'm from West Virginia, they'll say, "Oh, you know, my aunt lives in Richmond." And I'll say, "Well, that's, you know, Richmond is the capital of Virginia, but I live in the state beside it. So I'm really happy for your aunt, but I have no idea what that has to do with me." Right. Right. So that's just part of it. But, you know, I think a lot of the history of West Virginia comes from the fact that it was an agrarian society until around 1850. And post 1850, coal was discovered and railroads started building railroads into the mountains. And there became a separation between the property owner and the mineral rights. And there has been an ongoing battle since the 1850s and 60s until present day between the owners of the mineral rights and the owners of the surface. And the owners of the surface land are the ones that are stuck with the pollution. They're stuck with the people that up and leave. But, you know, I think the most troubling part about are the economics. And if you look at West Virginia, there just is a lack of economic prosperity. And much of that is driven from the fact that the owners of the mineral rights in the state reside outside the borders. And so when they make their profits, they're not reinvested in the state. They're reinvested where they reside, maybe New York, maybe Boston, maybe Baltimore, maybe DC, maybe even Richmond, but it's not there. And so the people there, they're very hardworking. They're good people. And there's a lot of people that come in from out of the state and really scar the beautiful landscape. And it's a source of contention for anybody that's there. Yeah.
Can imagine. So let's talk about your book, Appalachian Kid, How Hope Changed Everything. Give us the 30,000 foot. What's the big takeaway if somebody wants to pick up this book and read it?
Sure. So the book is a memoir about my life. I grew up in the 1980s in a small mining community in north central West Virginia. And like I said, I grew up in a violent home. And the book shares a lot about my upbringing and then my difficulties going into high school and college and really the ins and outs of having post-traumatic stress disorder and not knowing I had it. And I'm pretty raw in my account of seeking solutions that were not solutions at all. And, you know, one of them was alcohol. And over the years, I was someone who used alcohol to function. It covered up my symptoms of PTSD. And the more troubling symptoms have been insomnia, flashbacks, nightmares, broken fight or flight response. You know, I'll out of nowhere on a nice Sunday afternoon, I'll feel internally like a bomb threat was called in. But, you know, it just talks about my story. And, you know, there are a couple of things about my book that I feel are unique. I'm a huge reader, but I'm not a writer. This is the first time I've written anything. This is my first published work in any way, shape, or form. I bookend my book with a story of going to my hometown high school to volunteer for a one-day program called Building Hope. And chapter one, after my mini rant about what it's like to be from West Virginia and what my hometown and what the surrounding area is like, I get into driving to my hometown high school to volunteer at this Building Hope event. And I say in chapter 11, when I tell the details of that day, that that day changed my life. It changed the lenses of my life and how I saw my own story. And it was the catalyst really was three of the four kids that were in my small group and just their stories. And three of the four kids, they were freshmen in high school. They've now graduated, but you know, they were victims of violence. And talking to young people who are going through it in the moment was something that I'd never done before, even though I lived that life. And so my book is it tells my journey. It's bookended by this story of volunteering at my hometown high school and these kids changing my life. But it also explains what hope is. And when the reader gets to the end, they realize that I say my life is a miracle. And it really is. And I tell all through the book what the miracle is, but I just don't say it. And I think it's neat because my ending is not really about me. It's about those people who helped me get from A to B and changed the trajectory of my life. And they rolled up their sleeves and most of them had no idea what they even did or that they did anything. And so it's just an interesting book. I've got a lot of good feedback about it. And most of it has been, it's either helped somebody who has had a background like that, or who has struggled with alcohol addiction, or, you know, something that I've struggled with. Or the other feedback, the common response I get is, I've never read a book like this. And so it's kind of neat not being a writer, but I guess now you can say I'm an author. I found a way to write a unique story, and I credit God because it's his story. It's not mine.
Yeah. So you mentioned in chapter one, there was a lot in there. It's really great. But this one part really jumped out at me. You said government was non-existent. The only way to survive was to love your neighbor and hope they reciprocated. But then you go on to describe this 1980, this terrible flood in 1985, yeah. and some amazing feats of kindness and love. You talked about the Christmas gifts.
Yeah.
You know, all these kids had Christmas gifts, and then you had all these kids that were displaced, and they purposely made it so that the children who had suffered the most got the gifts. And then you kind of, I mean, what's interesting is you look at this story and you juxtapose that amazing kindness against the lack of understanding of mental illness.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting to see how these people are very kind, but they don't really understand what kind of suffering that people go through in their minds. And just witnessing all that as younger eyes, when did that kind of cohesiveness come together and you just ran into that understanding?
I honestly, the part about that, that's a good question. I can answer it a number of ways, but from my earliest memory, I just remember being in a community where people helped people, and it's the truth. And the flood we experienced in my community in 1985 was from Hurricane Juan, and it was a tropical depression. But when hurricanes come over the mountains, they tend to stay. And so they dump a lot of rain and they don't really move. And because it's a poor community, because it's in the middle of nowhere, because we're not in the age of information at that time, it was not like you would see a Hurricane Katrina when it wiped out New Orleans. Not that I'm comparing New Orleans to Kingwood, West Virginia, but you know, you did see the government step in. You saw white FEMA trailers. You saw relocations. You saw help. The only thing you saw in my community was the National Guards clearing the road. That's it. There were people that knocked on my parents' door at 2 or 3 in the morning when that flood occurred. There was an old couple who almost got wiped out. They were in water up to their necks. And my parents lived up on a mountain. And they knew that. And they came up and they stayed with us for months. And everyone in my community had someone living with them. And I didn't hear a word about it. No one was complaining that they had people with them, or no one was complaining that they lost their house. Everyone just worked together to rebuild the community. And that speaks volumes for the people that I grew up with. But at the same time, Jason, there's this parallel of you're in a hard-nosed place, right? And when you talk about coal miners, I would not want to run into a coal miner in a dark alley if it was an adversary. Because you have to think about the nature of what they're doing. They're going underground every day. And so you kiss your family goodbye and you honestly don't know if you're coming back. My family, generations of my family were coal miners. There were many of my great uncles who died in roof fall accidents, or, you know, maybe made it halfway on the train ride to the hospital. It's a hard life. And because of that, these people are tough. And so it's just, there's the complaining's not in their DNA. It's just, you know, if you live in a tough household or you've had to deal with some adversity, okay, brush it off, get up and move on. And it's not that they don't have a heart, they don't understand. And that's okay, right? Because their heart's in the right place, they just don't know.
Yeah, understood, yeah. I think the most astounding thing, and you mentioned it earlier, is, I mean, you've even written in your book, I Am No Victim. You said everything that has happened has been for a higher purpose.
Yes, sir.
And it's amazing to see you to live that out. Somebody listening to this is in similar circumstances or is in a hardship. What encouragement can you offer them?
Well, I would say this, Jason. If you're a follower of Jesus Christ and you're listening to this story right now, you are no victim, right? And and you may not understand it to the degree that I now do. I had to live through the difficulties and get to the other end to be able to see this the way I have. And I believe that my calling in life is to share my story to help others get to the other side. And that really is, I'm not a prideful person, but that is something that motivates me every day to do. I believe if you are knocked down, you just get up and fight and you don't accept your circumstances, because what is going to happen to you if you give it credibility and you stay mired in difficulty. Probably not very much.
Yeah, right. You just, I mean, if you don't get up, you don't move. Mm. You don't move forward.
Yeah. And you know, if you get up and fight, Jason, I've said this a number of different ways, but if you get up and fight, anybody who's come from a rough area, kind of like me, knows that it's always good to have someone watching your back, right?
Yes.
Who better to watch your back than the Lord God, right?
Right.
And it says in Isaiah 49 that if you put your faith in him, you won't be disappointed. And I believe God's promises, and I believe them to be true, and I've seen it lived out in my life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we there's so many stories of things just didn't go perfectly in the Bible. You know, you've got the wrestling with God and getting a limp. You've got Paul's thorn in his side. You know, we're not going to live a perfect life, and God never promised that. What he promises is spiritual protection. And if you just keep getting back up, you deny the enemy his satisfaction.
That's right.
You know, Job is a whole book of that. You just get knocked down, you just get back up. And eventually you'll get your reward. It may be, maybe this life, maybe, you know, maybe in the afterlife, the next life, but you'll get it.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about your faith journey. Actually, before we do that, a little side note, the end of chapter 2, you mentioned that you took a 23andMe DNA test, and it couldn't compute your genetic profile. I mean, that just astounds me.
That's right. I share with the reader that my ancestors are from all over. My great grandmother was Japanese. My other great grandmother was from Wales, and part of my family's from Ireland, Northern Ireland, and the other part from Germany, I believe. But I didn't know what my ancestry really was until I wrote that chapter. That was interesting. Yeah.
Oh, have you tried Ancestry or any other platform, or you just kind of gave up?
No, I just haven't had time, Jason. I wrote the book and now I'm doing these, and I just haven't got to get into the details.
Fair enough. Them. I just found that was so amusing to me. I'm like, wow, that's a melting pot right there.
Oh yeah. It's fine.
So on to your faith journey, are there any important highlights that led to you becoming the man of faith you are today? Anything, I mean, you talk about a lot of it in the book, but I mean, is there a significant moment that really stands out for you?
Oh, absolutely. And I write about it in chapter 9. So when I was a college student, I began to realize that something was wrong. When I was in high school, I kind of thought something was wrong. But when I say something was wrong, it was all symptoms of PTSD, right? And so I found out early in college that if I drank alcohol, it covered up those symptoms. And it allowed me to function. It allowed me to sleep, if you could call a blackness, you know, pass out sleep. But I at least was having rest with no nightmares. And so I continued that bad habit on of painting over rust into my mid-30s, and I started to turn sheet white, and I didn't know why. And so I went to the doctor, and the doctor told me that my liver was processing alcohol, and it wasn't processing the vitamins that I was consuming. And so I was malnourished, and I couldn't keep food down. I looked awful. My eyes were bloodshot, and I was sheet white, and I started to realize that I needed to quit drinking. And that is when I found out that I was hooked. And I had drank like 10 years every day, day after day. It didn't take a break. And it allowed me to function at a very high level. I was a CEO of a company, and I wasn't someone who was missing work or late or not functioning. I was functioning at a very high level. So when my body began to break down, I started to quit, Jason, and I couldn't. I tried for several weeks, and I couldn't make it past, you know, really 7 o'clock in the evening. And I was a single parent at the time, and I had a 11-year-old boy looking at me, and I just kept thinking, you know, if I keep doing this until I die, what's this kid going to do? And I was okay if I wasn't going to inhabit this earth anymore. I was really suffering that much from PTSD. And I didn't even know what I had. I was misdiagnosed for 10 years. And I was put on all kinds of medication. It didn't help me. And so I kind of gave up with trying to quit. I went out with a friend to a bar on a Saturday night. And at midnight, he asked me, what's wrong? And I told him. And he just looked at me and he said, why don't you go to church with me tomorrow? Would you do that? And I was just floored. You know, I wish my first comment was, yes, I'll go. But Jason, my first question was, you go to church? Yeah. Right. What? Church? We're at a bar. It's midnight. I just had this feeling come over me like, this is your lifeline. And the hairs on my arm stood up and I knew. And I went to church and lightning didn't strike me. I just felt this peace come over me. And I listened to what the pastor said and it was awesome. And it was just about how God meant for me to live my life. It was like he was talking right to me. And so it wasn't like a light switch. I went back for a few Sundays and eventually stirred up enough strength to make the decision to go to rehab. And I prayed the night before I left. I prayed and I just asked God to take the urges away. I said, I'm done with this, God. Just help me get over the hump. Take the urges away, because I had been trying to quit and I couldn't. Those urges, that is every cell in your body telling you it wants alcohol and your body's anticipating it. And if your pleasure center doesn't get it, it wrecks your world. You sweat, you shake. It is very, very, very uncomfortable and you can die from it. I didn't know that at the time. I only knew that after I went to rehab. And so when I left and went to rehab, I just was very positive. I went in to my examination. That's the first time that I was diagnosed with PTSD, complex PTSD. And I just told the doctor, I said, I'm going to beat this. Put it on my chart. I'm telling you right now, I'm going to beat this. I just took steps of faith, right? And when I got up to my room, I slept for a few days and then I cracked the Bible and I started trying to read it. But when you go to rehab and you're in detox, you're put on a tranquilizer. And so it's really hard to read the Bible on Ativan. I remembered in my room that my church I started going to in Morgantown, West Virginia, taped their services. So I got on their website and lo and behold, there were years worth of services on their website. And I just started listening. And one night of that led to the next. And I couldn't read, but I could listen. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, Jason, listening to a pastor named Tim Herring at Chestnut Ridge Church in Morgantown, West Virginia, changed my life. And it wasn't him that changed my life. It was Jesus. But that's what he was speaking about, right? He was just a messenger. And I'm telling you, I went from being someone who was highly addicted to alcohol and thinking he wouldn't see 38 years old to having a whole new life. And my life changed. I don't want to ruin the rest of the book for you, but in every way, shape, and form.
Absolutely. That's a great story. Thank you for sharing that. It seems like you've come a long ways. It seems like you've overcome quite a bit. What is God doing in your life today? Like, what's the next 3-5 years look like for you?
Well, right now, I run an infrastructure company, a large infrastructure company, United Infrastructure Group. They're based in Charlotte. The business is 100 years old. I'm currently the president and I'm a director. I work with 900 men and women at that company, and it runs on Christian values and principles. We pray, we take acts of faith in our company and within our families. And we do a lot of good with some of the profits that we make. We invest those into ministries and churches in South Carolina and in North and in the surrounding areas. So that's, you know, it's wonderful to be able to go to work and to have kingdom impact, right? So that's what's going on there. With my book, I have been on numerous podcasts and I've done some radio interviews. Really haven't got into speaking yet, but the impact that my book has had on listeners and readers who have either read the book or listened to the book has been just really encouraging. You know, I've had a lot of people who have either been through the storm reach out and say, hey, this is really a good book. I've had dads reach out to me and say, I read your book and I bought 3 more copies and gave them to my children. Wow. I was hoping a couple people would read my book if I even got a publishing deal, right? And by the way, it took 2 days to get a publishing deal. That's God.
That is amazing.
Romans 8:28, he's using my story for good, right? Yep. And that's his promise, and his promises are true. I don't know what the future holds. I'm currently working on a book, writing another book for Forbes Books, but I just want to help other people. And if that's through sharing my story on podcasts, through speaking, or I have actually given my book away to numerous rehabs all over the country, Christian rehabs, I've given it to churches and just tried to share my story in a way that can help those struggling find a way through the struggle, right? And so I don't really know what God has planned for me. My hopes are I can just continue to have impact and the Lord will let me stay here on earth to watch my children grow up and my 2 boys to be men, and whatever he wants me to do, I like to say I'm going to do it, but of course you don't know what he's going to have you do and what the future holds, right? So we all know that plans from God can be way different than the plans we have for ourselves, and his plans are better than ours. So whatever I have planned, I'm sure that his is better, and I'm going to do it.
I have a friend who tells me, if you want to make God laugh, tell him about your plans.
Yeah. I think that's a C.S. Lewis quote too.
Is it?
Yeah.
That would make sense. So. Well, John, this has been a real treat for me. Thank you so much for sharing, for coming on my humble little podcast. Before we wrap up, do you have any last words, any final thoughts for the listeners?
Yeah, I just like to say a little blip for those people who are struggling. You know, all podcasts have listeners of people who have been through more than others. And so I just like to say that if you're someone who's struggling, just know that I have tried everything out there. I really tried just about every solution there is, and I only ever found one that worked. And it was faith in Jesus Christ. And I say that because that is the answer. And it worked for me and it will work for you. If you knock, he will answer. And I would just encourage you, whatever difficulty you're going through, whether it's drugs, alcohol, trauma, loss of job, you know, there are all kinds of adversities out there. That is the answer. And I would encourage you to do so. And the catalyst that helped me to get from the abyss to where I am now was just simply hope. And if I may, Jason, I'll just share a little bit about hope.
Yeah, go for it.
Many people understand hope as wishful thinking. If you would look it up in the dictionary, that's the definition you would find, wishful thinking. The true definition of hope can be found in the Bible. And when you look at the Bible, or when you read the Bible, hope is a confident expectation that God's promises will come to pass. And so if you know what God's promises are, then you have hope. All you have to do is wait. And I did it, and it worked for me, and it will work for you too. You just have to get up and fight.
There you have it, John. Thank you so much. If you're intrigued by his story, I strongly urge you to grab his book, Appalachian Kid, How Hope Changed Everything. You can find links to it in the show notes, his website, his social media. It's on Amazon. Google it. It'll be out there. You can find it. But definitely pick up a copy. It's a story that you will never forget. And I think there's a little bit of something in there for everyone, if I might be so bold. But until next time, remember to be kind to each other. Remember to read your Bibles. May the Lord bless you and keep you. So God bless the listeners and God bless you, John.
Thank you.
You've just finished listening to the My Ministry Mission podcast, where faith's transformative power comes to life. Please be sure to like and subscribe this podcast on your favorite app so you never miss an episode. Also, be sure to check out today's show notes for great links and information you may have missed. Have a blessed week, and we'll see you next time.